Ryan Murphy. Agus tá fáilte ró, cos dhéanúr gaile contra ar chin néga seachtaní ar Maidin Donog show. Good Monday, Sunday morning and welcome to another edition of the Gaelic Hour here on Chin, 97.9 FM. We are coming to you live over the air, but you can also find this program out on the internet, www.thegaelichour.ca, and we have the magazine shows are archived there, and also we put a playlist list up of the music we play. Today's list isn't up yet, we'll have it up probably about 9:30. You'll find a calendar on the web, and we have some local events listed there, and I want to tell you about a few of those. And we have links also to some of the other Irish organisations. And if you want to drop me a line, the email address is austin@thegaelichour.ca. And this programme is brought to you in part by the generous support I received from the Heart and Crown and also the Monterey Inn Resort. And I also wish to thank the friends of the Gaelic Hour. Consider becoming a friend of the Gaelic Hour and support local Irish broadcasting, and you will receive your copy of Irish Connections Canada, which is published 3 times yearly. Again, visit the website www.thegaelichour.ca and you can get more information there. And speaking of our sponsors, the Heart and Crown and the Monterey both provide wonderful brunches down at the Monterey. It gets underway around 10 a.m. and at 10:30 at the Heart and Crown on Preston Street. So if you want to head out, good place to go. And this weekend, the British Isles Family History Society of Greater Ottawa, their annual conference has been underway at Library and Archives Canada, and I spent some time up there on Friday night and yesterday, and today is the wrap-up day. Lots of interesting lectures going on, and if you're interested in genealogy at all, there's an area in the lobby of Library and Archives. You can go in, wander around, and you can find information on family history, how to go and research it, lots of stuff like that. Mark your calendars. October 20th, 5 female Irish writers are coming here to Ottawa, and it's for one night only, and we'll be doing a reading down at St. Bridget's at St. Patrick Street, and it is a fundraiser for Heart and Stroke. We had Helen Hansen on here, and she told us about how she had a stroke, and she was brought over to Ireland and met Catherine Dunn, and Catherine introduced her to some of the other ladies who have volunteered to come over here and help raise funds for stroke awareness and the impact that it can have on writing and verbal skills and all that. So something to be looked forward to. So the other one I want to mention, of course, is John P. Kelly has his play A Flea in Her Ear, and that is opening in the Gladstone. But today I'm going to introduce you to our new Deputy Head of Mission at the Embassy of Ireland, and I have Hilary Riley in studio here with me. Good morning, Hilary, and welcome to the Gaelic Hour.
Thanks, Austin. Delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for getting out of bed at this unearthly hour. I know when you and I got to say hello first, and I sat down and I said, where are you from? And we worked our way through from there. So where are you from?
I'm from County Offaly, born and bred, a small place called Rahan, about 7 miles outside Tullamore.
Yeah.
Grew up there and went to school there, and I think my family come there from many generations. I haven't been able to trace them anywhere else.
Is Riley is a name that is, it's not peculiar to around that area of Offaly though, is it?
It's not, and Riley is actually my married name.
Okay.
I'm originally O'Brien, and I met a gentleman called Daniel Riley when I was working in the States, and we ended up getting married. So he's actually a good Irish American.
Right. And Rann is quite an historic spot and a quiet spot. You have there's the Abbey out there, isn't it?
Yeah, there's St. Carthage was a saint who set up an abbey there around 790 AD, and the ruins of the monastery are still there down by the banks of the River Clodagh. It's an unusual name. I think the only place you find the name Carthage in Ireland is in the parish of Rahan, where I'm from, and Lismore in County Waterford, where I believe he also went. So there's a lot of people called Carthage in
well,
the
you get it
area.
A little bit farther north as well, because there were quite a few of them around Clara.
Oh, yeah, indeed.
And they were referred to as Catch.
Catch, yeah. Yes, indeed. Yeah. But, yeah, it's a very, it was a very rural community, and I grew up on a farm, so I always spent the summers turning turf and baling hay and all of that.
Right.
So you kind of, I've three brothers, but at the same time, everyone would have to pitch in and lend a hand.
And, of course, just north of Rahan, when you do mention cutting turf, Clara Bog is a
yes.
heritage site now, I believe.
It is, and actually quite a lot of tourists go there, and I think a lot of people from Germany in particular are interested in the whole flora and fauna. It has quite a unique flora and fauna, and it's also along the Esker, one of the Eskers left in the Ice Age, so it's a lovely spot, actually.
I know, because from a tourist perspective, it's not an area that, certainly 25 years ago, 30 years ago, that was on the tourist map.
No. But I think more and more, it was probably a place you'd stop off on the way to the west of Ireland, coming
right.
from Dublin. But I think there's a few things there, like the bog and the canal as well. The Grand Canal goes through Tullamore, and there's the Sleaf Blooms down in other parts of the county. So, yeah, there's plenty to see, all right.
And, of course, you're in the Taoiseach's home territory all around there.
That's right, yes. It's a small enough locality, all right.
So, you say you grew up there, farming family, and
yeah.
you went to school. What got you into the diplomatic service?
Well, I suppose I was always interested in either being a teacher or a civil servant. I think I grew up in a household. I was fortunate that my granny, my father's mother, lived with us when we were growing up, and she had lived through the War of Independence and the Civil War, and she was always interested in the state and what was going on, and was always listening to the radio and watching Today Tonight back in the 80s. So I suppose I grew up very conscious of you know, the nation and state and so on. And I had a couple of aunts who were teachers. So I loved Irish in school. So I went off to UCG to study Irish, was going to study history, and then took on sociological and political studies, or SOC and POL for short, and became very interested in that. So ended up doing that for my degree. And I think I was the last year of college, the Public Appointments Commission, I think they go around the universities with a sort of a recruitment seminar explaining the various jobs in the service and so on. And there was a lady there from Foreign Affairs, and I remember thinking, wow, that would be very interesting, and I probably have no hope, but sure, I'll try anyway. So I did the various exams and went through the recruitment process, and every stage I got, I said, oh, sure, that'll be it, I'll try again next year. But anyway, we got in. So, yeah, I think it was the mix of, you know, the opportunity to travel and to represent your country is a huge honour and privilege. I just thought it would be interesting. And I always liked languages as well. I took French and German for my leaving cert and did Irish in college. So.
Of course, in Galway, you must have found that, because I know you have an interest in Irish music, and we'll talk about that in a minute, but you must have found that the scene in Galway, the music scene in Galway, is very, very vibrant. And, of course, then you're on the doorstep of Connemara, so you have traditional everything.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose when I was thinking of studying Irish, I thought Galway was a good place to go. Yeah, there's very vibrant Irish music everywhere, through pubs and community centres and theatre as well, of course.
That's
with
right,
the Arts Festival on Tydark and Connemara as well. Yeah, I used to spend my summers out in Connemara, both as a student learning Irish and then volunteering there as well in the Gaeltacht. So,
Well, that's a nice segue, because one of the pieces of music you did select was Sharon Shannon and Monday. And, of course, with the Galway Girl. Now, while Sharon Shannon is Clare, Galway has been Galway. And Monday, of course, was only up the road. not that far from Rahan.
That's right. I think he's from Shinrone, down near Bor.
And
he's done very well for himself. And he's a very big selling artist now as well. I think it's a nice version of the song as well.
Right.
Something lively.
And in the first hour here this morning, Hilary has picked the music. And this piece is Sharon Shannon and Monday and Galway Girl. And you are listening to the Gaelic Hour here on Chin 97.9 FM.
Took a stroll on the old long walk with AI. I met a little girl and we stopped to talk. Find soft AI. And I asked your friend, what's a fella to do? Cause her hair's black and her eyes are blue. And I knew right then, I'd be taking a whirl. And I saw till prime with a Galway.
That was Monday, Sharon Shannon and the Galway Girl. And, of course, Sharon Shannon has collaborated with lots of people. Wonderful musician, isn't she?
Oh, she is. She's fantastic, absolutely. Yeah. And her, she can play anything from very traditional music to bringing in some other influences as well. Yeah.
In a lot of ways, as a result of that, she successfully helps revitalise the whole interest in Irish music.
Yeah, I think so. I think while it's important to always remember the traditional sense of music, it's lovely to see kind of a cross-fertilisation of other forms of music coming into trad, you know, with a bit of maybe jazz influence or Cajun, of course. It's great. And things like Riverdance have, of course, opened up the whole gamut of Irish music.
So your own music then? You're a musician.
I am. Well, I try to play a bit, I would say. Yeah, I played the flute and tin whistle, and I started when I was about 5 years old, and I suppose I took lessons fairly intensively up till I was 12, 13, and through school. I played a bit still in college, and then with work and that, I sort of eased off a bit. But I haven't been playing as much in recent years, but I try and play a bit when I can or when I'm at home.
Yeah, we're going to try and get you back into some of that. Great thing about the flute and the tin whistle, of course, is when you want to carry them with you, they're not huge, big things.
Exactly, yeah, they're easier to transport
than a harp.
Than a harp or something, yeah. And I remember some years ago when I was in college, I played with Rahan Coltis at home in Offaly, and we went on a trip to London. And there were great shenanigans because one of the gentleman lost his Illan pipes, and they're not easily replaced. Well, the airline did find them eventually, but as you say, things like that are more difficult to transport on aeroplanes.
Yeah, you can't pull one out of your pocket.
No, you can't.
For an impromptu session.
No, you can't.
So when you joined the service, and did you go straight into foreign affairs?
I did, yes, yeah, more or less. I did my degree in Galway, and I did a master's in Galway as well. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I joined the department in 1999. Yeah, I got.
So then your initial period, of course, would have been Dublin based, I'm sure. And no one is sent abroad straight off.
No, but I pretty much close to straight off, as it happened, I was. I was based in the economic division or EU division, as it is now, just dealing with external trade issues initially. And when I was about 10 months in, a vacancy came up at the Irish Embassy in Berlin fairly quickly. So I was one of the few people at grade left in Dublin who had German, so with some degree of German. So I was sent out within 5 weeks. I packed my bags and I was out there. So that was a learning curve as well for me.
And that must have put you at a tremendous advantage because I do know when people arrive in many countries, the first thing they have to do is learn the language.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So for you that you had French, German, ready to go, certainly must have put you at a real advantage.
It did. And I mean, the department is very good with encouraging language training as well and preparing. Normally, people would get about 9 months' notice if they're going, and you can sort of after hours and do kind of intensive language training. But it was certainly a great help that I had some degree of German, although I thought I spoke good German till I actually got out there and realised it's one thing kind of learning grammar and vocabulary in school and quite another trying to actually do some of your work through German. Or even I remember my washing machine broke down and trying to explain to the technician, the lad who came to fix it in German, what was wrong with it was challenging to say the least.
I can well imagine.
We didn't have English, but it was great. And in some ways, it's as anyone I think who moves abroad to a country like Germany, you know, they will probably say as well, one of the best ways is to immerse yourself in the country and the culture, mm-hmm. and kind of, you know, learn the hard way in some ways, but it stands to you in the end, I think.
Given the job you do and the opportunities you get to travel, when you go to somewhere like Germany, you know, one of the things about the Irish language, for example, and the German language, they're both very guttural.
Yes. Yes.
And you would probably be in a better position to see what would be similarities in races and ethnicities of where and differences.
Mm-hmm.
So when you find yourself in somewhere like Germany, even though it's in Europe, and in Germany, as I understand it, Irish music and the Irish artists do very well in Germany.
Yes, extremely well. Yeah.
Were you able to figure out or sense why?
I think there are quite strong links as well. I know down in Würzburg in the south of Germany, St. Killian, there's lots of German children called Killian because St. Killian had a monastery there. So, but also there's a lot of Irish people in Germany as well who bring that. I think the Germans have always been very interested in Ireland, and I think after Britain, they're the next biggest possibly visitors from Europe. But I think it's just the imagery of their mountains and lakes and so on and outdoor right. things. But it is, yeah, it's quite a prominent.
So then to
there.
Be thrown in at a relatively inexperienced stage. In comparison to what someone who had might have been in the service for a number of years, it must have been very exciting.
It was exciting. It was challenging, but it was exciting. I had some great colleagues, of course, who I worked with, who were fantastic. And you figure things out as you go along. It was ultimately a very rewarding experience.
So how long did you spend in Germany?
3 years.
Right. And then back to Dublin?
No, on the way to Dublin, I was sent to Brussels for a year because at that stage we were coming up to Ireland's presidency of the European Union in 2004. And when you're in a presidency scenario, you need a lot of extra hands on deck and people to chair meetings and so on. So I was sent there for a year on the way back.
Right. And I know to the man the street. You know, all these things, it's like anything. You look at a movie and you've no clue what went on in the background, or you go to a play and you've no clue what went back on the background. And you look at television and you see the leaders or the various ministers sitting around a table, and there's no clue what goes on in the background. Having, I suppose, as you grew up or seen 7 days and whatever, and then found yourself to be one of the ones that was behind the scenes, it must have been a tremendous eye-opener.
It was. No, it was great. It really was. And you learn so much about the huge machinery that is actually in the background. For example, when you see you've the heads of state and government who meet in the European Council four right. times a year, maybe more often if they need to, and everything kind of works up to that. But across all the subject and policy areas. You know, you have officials at working group level, sort of on the very detailed level, and then they will, you know, agree stuff, and it goes on up to the ambassadors to the EU, and they prepare the councils of ministers, lots of things are in the mix and are working.
So, in other words, the 10-sentence communique at the end. Is the filter, the filtration and distillation of 20 or 30 pages.
Yeah, it can be, or 20 or 30 hours of negotiations as well, because as you can imagine, with so many countries with such diverse interests as well, it's actually, quite extraordinary when you think of how you can get to a common agreement on certain things as well. And
that must be fascinating.
Yeah, it is. And negotiating, and in the presidency scenario, you kind of have to stand back and. Just listen to everyone's views and try and come to a common compromise and talk to this one and talk to that one right. and bring them together and see would they agree, and then would that everyone else agree to things. So it's quite interesting.
Right. So then you got back to Dublin.
I got back to Dublin then, yes. And I worked on the Asia desk in our political division. So dealing with Ireland's relations with countries across Asia, including China, India, Japan, and many more. I think we covered about 32 in all. But that was interesting. I was only there for a year, but it was very interesting.
Now, when you said the political division mm-hmm. within the foreign affairs, how many divisions are there as such? Like, I'm sure there's trade.
Yeah, there's the Promoting Ireland Abroad division, and that right. kind of encompasses. Trade, Department of Enterprise, Trade and Investment has a role there with the agencies, Enterprise Ireland and IDEA, of course, and right. then we would link in with them, and that includes culture as well, so Promoting Ireland Abroad is kind of trade and culture, and right. we have the political division, which deals with kind of our bilateral relations, also our multilateral relations. The United Nations is a big sort of cornerstone of our foreign policy. So you deal with that there. And then there's the EU division, which sort of has oversight of all that goes on in the European Union. And we have the Anglo-Irish division.
Okay.
Deals with relations with our neighbours across the way and up north as well. And then we've the Passport and Consular Division, which encompasses the Passport Office as well.
Right.
And we have then just the legal division as well, just in terms of, because we have a role in ratifying treaties and so on.
Right.
Yeah, so there's quite I probably left one out now,
yeah.
But and corporate services, of course, for internal running the operation.
Right.
Yeah.
Hilary, we're going to take a short break and we'll come back to you after these messages from our advertisers.
The Hart and Crown Irish Pubs had their humble beginnings in the heart of the Byward Market in 1992. The Snug Pub was opened in 1997. Mother McGinty's and Rushing Doves were added in 2001, and now, in 2010, The Druid. You can also visit the Hart and Crown on Preston Street, the Old Dubliner and Poorhouse on York Street, and the James Street Pub on Bank Street. The Hart and Crown Irish Pubs for quality food and entertainment.
just lay here, would you lie with me and just forget the world?
And that was Snow Patrol. And Snow Patrol, it's a group. Hilary, tell us a bit about Snow Patrol.
I suppose I chose them because I really liked the song and I really liked the group. I think they're a bunch of lads. I believe they met when they were studying in Edinburgh, and two of them are from Bangor in County Down. Yeah. And I think one other guy is from Scotland and one from the UK, but don't quote me on that. But I think they're a great young band, and that song as well. I think I first heard it on Grey's Anatomy, the TV show. I don't know if anyone else watches medical drama, but yeah, I think they're a great
and
band.
Of course, that piece was called Chasing Cars.
Yeah,
indeed. Yeah. So we were chatting there, and you were telling us the divisions that you have there in DFS. So after you got back, and you're in Dublin for a year, where'd you go, or what happened?
I was sent to the consulate in Chicago, and there for a couple of years. So that was great. So that Chicago is a very, very Irish city.
Very different, I would imagine, having started your career in Germany, now to find the North American experience.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, no, the North American experience is quite different to the European experience, I suppose, because of the historic waves of immigration and the fact that, you know, the Irish heritage and culture is so embedded in North America. Mm-hmm. And certainly in Chicago, everyone you met, there's so many Irish names, and if you look at Mayor Daley in the City Hall, and all over the place, there are Irish links, and of course they dye the River Green on St. Patrick's Day.
Yeah.
But we also covered we covered 20 states in the Midwest out of Chicago as well, so quite all the way over to Ohio, right down to Louisiana.
And that would be predominantly for trade.
Trade and consular services for citizens there, passports, citizenship and consular assistance and so on was the bulk of my work at the time, and people applying for visas to Ireland.
So what period of time are we talking, Celtic Tiger or post-Celtic Tiger?
I suppose the economy, you know, was doing very well. It was around the mid-noughties, as you'd say, so around 05 to early 07.
So there was a lot of migration, but it was at a time when there was demand and the people coming over were probably coming straight into jobs.
You mean people
from Ireland, from a consular?
There's always a lot of demand. I mean, some certain nationalities need visas to go to Ireland, even if it's for a business trip or a holiday.
Right.
So there's a kind of a steady stream of that, those categories of applicants as well. But also there were a lot of young Irish people coming out as well to take up opportunities in the States. An awful lot of people there already, but, you know, a lot of people coming over to work, say, with accounting firms that are multinationals and so on. So there was plenty over there.
So coming from Rahan and finding yourself in Chicago, not that people from rural Ireland haven't found themselves in the large cities of North America, very different experience in every respect.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. A very different. I mean, you're living in a huge metropolis of a city. But I suppose I was lucky in that I had a kind of a gradual transition to city life, because I left Rahan to go to college in Galway. Yeah. So that was kind of small city life, which is it's more like, I think, a big town than a city. And then I moved up to Dublin and then in various places. But very different. And I'm sure a lot of people who've emigrated through the years have found the transition.
And of course, there's a great buzz in Chicago and like some other American cities that it's vibrant with pedestrians.
It is. It's very vibrant. And I suppose the central sort of Michigan Avenue, the central drag, is kind of the big sort of shopping street and where art galleries and so on are. And it's also on the banks of Lake Michigan. It's beautiful. I mean, the Great Lakes are phenomenal. They're more like, I think, being at the coast, and because you stretch as far as the eye can see as well.
Which causes me to switch gears slightly, because along the Millennium Park there in Chicago, it is beautiful, but it's where you see an awful lot of outdoor activity.
Yeah.
Are you into any of these? Have you any sporting pastimes?
I'm not the most sporty of people. I do like cycling and walking. We just got secondhand bicycles there, so we've been out on the Rideau Canal and in the evenings and when we get a chance, and it's absolutely beautiful, I have to say. It seems to be a great city for outdoor life. So walking and cycling, I mean, I'd follow the GAA, but I've never played or anything like that. So, and my husband being American, he's trying to get me into ice hockey and American football and all these things.
as a spectator.
As a spectator, yes. Definitely as a spectator.
So as a spectator, are you going to have any interest in next week's All-Ireland?
I'm going to be, unfortunately, out of the country. My brother-in-law is getting married down in New Jersey, so I don't think I'll be able to get to watch it, but I'll be keeping an eye on the internet. But I'd say it'll be an interesting game anyway.
Right.
Yeah.
So moving along after Chicago, back home for a while.
Yeah, I was back home for just over 3 years. So right. I worked in the Anglo-Irish division on North-South cooperation on the island, and that was very, very interesting. A lot going on. I moved back in 2007, just after the power sharing institutions got up and running again. The Assembly and the Executive in Northern Ireland, and I worked primarily on issues relating to the North-South Ministerial Council, which is one of the institutions set up in Good Friday Agreement, mm-hmm. and it's where ministers from the Irish Government and the Northern Ireland Executive meet and discuss issues of mutual interest and where they can work together. So that had been suspended for the 5 years up to 2007, so that was fully up and running again in 2007. So it was a very exciting time mm-hmm. to go back into that and to work on all those issues.
Having spent some time working on it, are you hopeful?
Oh, I am, yes, definitely. Definitely. I mean, if you compare where we are now to where we were even 10 years ago, mm-hmm. Huge, huge strides have been made. You have Peter Robinson, Mark McGuinness sharing power, and politicians elected by the people from all traditions sitting around a table in the executive and, working on issues. Daily bread and butter issues on, mm-hmm. on Northern Ireland, and it's definitely huge strides forward have been made.
Yeah, and I was watching a program recently on the Boyne, and I know that there's a big celebration annually now, and that it's encouraging people from the north to come down, particularly the Unionists, to celebrate
yes.
their heritage from the Battle of the Boyne.
Absolutely.
In a positive way.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah, and I think it's the OPW have developed a sort of a historical site at the Battle of the Boyne, and I've actually been up there, and it's a very, very interesting site and so on, and I think visitors do come down from Northern Ireland and so on, and it's very interesting.
So at a public service level, there's then obviously civil servants on both sides of the border that are literally working side by side on a daily basis at this stage.
Yes, there's a joint secretariat in Armagh, and they're the secretariat to the North-South Ministerial Council, and they're all actually in the same building, civil servants from Northern Ireland departments and from our departments, and they're working to the work programme that's set out by the council and across a number of areas like transport, agriculture, environment, health and so on. And on a daily basis, yeah, and we would have met them in Dublin, met colleagues and people from Belfast and so on, and so it's very.
Now the downturn in the economy, I know, doesn't help a situation like that, because when people are struggling, it's very difficult in a way for them to put pain aside and kind of come together. They're so immersed in their own troubles of trying to put food on the table that a lot of times it's harder to rise above it. So I'm talking about very much at the ground level. Does that present, a challenge, if even in things like education or anything, to try and get beyond?
Yeah, I suppose, as I say, another way of looking at it, yeah, in terms of, you know, with a downturn, I suppose both administrations have to do more with less resources. So I know one of the things that we're looking at, we were looking at a north-south basis, was how we could both save money by working more closely together, you know, in terms of, after all, it's, you know, there's one island of, if you put the two populations together in both jurisdictions, you know, mm-hmm. you have 6 million people and so on, and whether there be economies of scale, if you're doing something, you know, would you need two? Could you do one close, you know, in an area that's suitable? So things like that, you know, I think So in some ways there's an opportunity there as well to work together.
And I know, well, tourism, of course, would be a prime example of that.
Yes, tourism. And in fact, Tourism Ireland, who a lot of people are probably familiar with, Tourism Ireland are actually a north-south body.
Yeah.
They work to promote the entire island, and they're overseen at home by both our own Department of Tourism, Culture and Sport and the Northern Department of Enterprise, Trade and Investment. So the CEO would report to both ministers, and and Tourism Ireland do a great job, I think, in promoting marketing the island overseas, because I suppose if you think about it, if you're in China or India, you know, you're just looking at this little dot on the mm-hmm. map over in the other side of Western Europe, and you know, so there's benefit to be had in saying, you know, come to the island and then you can, you know, go here and there and decide where to go and whatever.
And yet on an economic level, there must be an element of competition, because if the IDA particularly are trying to get investment, I doubt if they're trying to get investment in the north, given that, and I'm saying it in the nicest possible way, their job is to get jobs in the south.
Well, no, they have a specific remit, as indeed to invest Northern Ireland for Northern Ireland. Yeah. But at the same time, you know, there's always scope as well to work together. And I know they were doing a bit of work around marketing, say, the northwest of Ireland, you know, because the northwest, Donegal and Derry, you know, are so close together, you know, and if you get, chances are, if you get, you know, an investment in up there somewhere, it'll have spin-off effects on both sides, both Donegal and Derry. So there are areas of you know, where they can work together as well. Yeah, sure.
Now, the other thing I know was a scenario where you had an awful lot of people from the Republic of Ireland never in their breathing days would have crossed the border to go north, and vice versa, you had a whole population north of the border who never would have dreamed of crossing the border and going south. Has that changed?
I think so, definitely. As part of my work, I would often have to go up to meetings in Belfast or Armagh, and I'd take the enterprise train up, and there were times it was packed in both directions, you know, with people going up. And I suppose, I think people who lived close to the border would always have gone over and back. And I know two very close friends of mine, one from Cavan, one from Donegal, often talked in college about, you know, they would go to Derry to do the shopping or go to Enniskillen or whatever. But certainly, you know, a lot of people are going up. There's lots of, as well, you know, school groups going in both directions as well, you know, exchanges and so on. And I think I was in Belfast as well over weekend, and I saw, you see a lot of maybe people coming up for girls' weekends or whatever. You could hear southern accents and then vice versa. And I think it's there's definitely a lot more. And a lot of Irish students go to Queen's in Belfast, and a lot of quite a few northern students. Students will come down to college in Dublin and elsewhere. So there's quite a bit of mobility, I think.
Now, I did ask you a few months ago, were you hopeful? Because I know there has been, I won't quite say it, well, maybe it is a step backward, and that there has been a re-emergence of some discontent, particularly on what would have been the traditional Republican side. What are your senses?
Yeah, I mean, there have been, you'd have read in the papers as well, instance of bombs and so on being, you know, ones that either unexploded, mainly being left places, and dissident Republicans. But I mean, the answer has to be, you know, that this is not the way forward. The majority of the people want peace, and mm-hmm. they want stability and so on. And I think as well, this is, you know, dragging it back to the past. I think everything in the institutions are working. You know, the Police Service of Northern Ireland is up and running. You know, everything is in place, and you know, we have all politicians on all sides have condemned these attacks.
And of course, then a few months ago, we had the Savile reporter, and I think the dust has probably settled on that. There was the initial flurry.
Yes.
But that really was a form of cleansing.
Yeah, it was a huge thing. I mean, for the families of those who were killed and injured in Bloody Sunday, I can only imagine what it meant to them. It was years of campaigning, and it was indeed, it was a great thing that you know, the report came out in such a way, and was indeed very welcome.
So now you've arrived with us here, and you're looking forward to changing the world, changing Ottawa. what are you hoping, or what have you as a priority that you'd like to try and achieve here, or have you set your goals and objectives yet?
Well, I suppose I'm only here a couple of weeks, so I'm still in the process of that. But Canada is a huge country with a huge Irish heritage. So, I mean, I look forward to continuing to build on Carol's good work, and as I say, helping promote Ireland in Canada. Looking forward to working with various community groups and business organisations and so on. We're there always to, you know, to help where we can and so on. As I said, I'm still getting my head around things.
You're still struggling on the deep end.
We're getting there.
I'm wondering where the bottom is.
We're getting there. Well, it's actually it's such a huge country. I mean, it's so vast, and the level of provincial authority is very, very autonomy is quite strong. Rules and regulations in one province might be different in another province. So it's kind of getting a handle on that as well.
Actually, that is a good one, because I know I talked to Carl about this, and this was one of the things, that coming to grips with the different political systems, because when you go from Ireland, you know, we're very conscious that the national government controlled a lot of things. Really, the county councils didn't have a huge amount of power, except for maybe some planning, and not a huge amount. And then when you go to Germany, it's a federation in Germany.
It is. I know the Länder, the provinces there have a lot of autonomy as well.
And then you go down to the US and the states, mm-hmm. Individually have very different environments and laws. And then you come up in here, and again, it's the, what each province holds power over. And how it exercises that power can be very different.
Yeah, it can be different. And even, you know, just knowing who's who in the various provinces and which parties are in power and so on, part of our job is to, you know, interact with Canadian officialdom and Canadian colleagues as well.
So. Right. So have you got the skates yet for the winter?
No, I haven't. I don't have great balance, so I'm not sure that I'd be skating down the Rideau Canal to work every day. But my husband, again, he's more adept at that. Having grown up in Buffalo, he's uh, he's well used to snow and ice, so he's ready for action. But I'm not quite myself just yet.
Well, I know, like that, as I'm sure you were well briefed on. It's your first winter here; is the one you have to experience to get used to it.
That's it. That's it. Although someone once told me in the States as well, there's no bad winters, only bad clothes. So if you're not prepared and wrapped up well enough, you'll suffer. But if you kind of prepare for it, so we're in the process of preparing for that at the moment.
Right. And your husband, say he's from Buffalo.
He is.
He travels around with you.
He is. He's just, we only got married last year, so right. He's only just starting it. But he did move to Ireland with me from the States. So he spent 3 years in Ireland with me before we came out here.
Right. And he loved that.
He did, yes. Yeah, he is Irish-American. He actually has family down in Cork who we went down to visit in Skull, beautiful part of the country.
Indeed.
He very much enjoyed it. But again, I think it was interesting for him as an Irish American coming to Ireland, not just visiting on holidays, but living there. It's funny, he was noticing, you know, little things about Irish culture that I wouldn't even have noticed, maybe, or that's my family right. wouldn't have noticed, because being from Ireland, you don't pick up on things. You're so close to things.
You just take it for granted.
Yeah, but he loved it, and we had him down in Offaly, foot in turf and everything, so he thought he very much enjoyed that.
Well, down in Offaly is a good way to come back to where we nearly started, because... You were telling me one of your music teacher when you were starting to learn music was one of the Egans.
Yes, yeah, Eilish Egan from Clohan, and who's now a member of the Bridies.
Yeah.
As I discovered, I was listening to the Bridies CD and thought, wow, they're really good, and I love what they're doing with Irish music. And I did a bit of research on them, and I went, wait a minute, I know that person. Now it's been years since Eilish taught me, and she seems to have gone on and done great things. And I think she played with Riverdance and everything.
Brady Curtin went out.
So it's a small world. But I remember Eilish was she could play so many instruments. I remember her bringing in drums, fiddle, accordion, flute and everything. And you'd start off with the tin whistle, and then she'd try and
progress from there
to graduate and choose another instrument.
Right. Well, we're coming up near the top of the hour, and Hilary, I want to thank you for coming on the Gaelic Hour. It's been a pleasure having you here.
Thanks, Austin.
And as we get up towards the top of the hour, we will be going into An Nuacht, which is coming from Radio na Gaeltacht. And I do want to express my gratitude to RTE for giving us permission to rebroadcast the 8 o'clock news, followed by It Says in the Paper, and then at 9 o'clock An Nuacht. Hilary O'Reilly, thanks a million.
Thanks to you, Austin.
Come back after 9.